You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Open Society Foundations. My name is Kasia Malinowska-Sempruch. I work for the Global Drug Policy Program. One of the areas of our focus for the next couple of months are preparations to the UN General Assembly session on drugs that is taking place in New York in April. Number of us here are working towards making sure that the number of issues discussed during that meeting are broad rather than narrow. And obviously, drugs and the environment is one of the areas that we would like to make sure is included in those discussions. So we're very pleased to have all of you with us today. We will start with a very short address by Alex Soros, who is a board member of Open Society Foundations and also is in charge of Alex Soros Foundation. And then we'll hand over to Brian Winters, who has kindly agreed to chair the panel. So again, warm welcome to all of you, and let's start with Alex Soros.
Thank you for joining us for this evening's discussion on how drug control policies result in harm to the natural environment. As we prepare for the UNGA special session on the world drug problem this upcoming April, I am happy to announce that the Open Society Foundations are hosting a number of events and producing a number of reports on a range of drug policy topics. And we appreciate all of your participation in these discussions. I don't want to take up too much of your time today, but did want to address a few of the ways the war on drugs has devastated the environment, some of which I got to see firsthand while traveling in South America earlier this year, advocating for the rights of environmental and human rights defenders. Under our current policies, forced drug crop eradication is simply deforestation by another name. I spent time in places where there are hundreds of miles of virgin forest in each direction, but where the war on drugs is forcing farmers deeper and deeper into these regions, thus expanding the agricultural frontier. On top of this, many drug eradication programs incentivize monocrops, such as palm, mostly used to produce oil, to replace coca and other drug crops, which are often native plants, naturally growing, and as a result, much less harmful to the environment. Palm makes farmers reliant on a single crop for revenue and has had some of the worst effects on deforestation globally. Not to mention that the palm oil industry has been linked to some of the worst human rights violations. On another front, drug enforcement authorities also deploy toxic chemicals to eradicate coca through aerial fumigation campaigns, also known as spraying. These chemicals poison wildlife, harm food crops, contaminate water sources, kill animals, and have had negative health impacts on local residents. I commend the Colombian government on their recent decision to outlaw spraying, and I only hope that other countries soon follow suit. I hope that we will successfully put an end to the war on drugs for the sake of the environment, which we all share. Enjoy tonight's discussion, and I'm sorry I can't be there with you to partake.
Okay, well, good evening. Thank you all for being here. My name is Brian Winter. I'm the editor of America's Quarterly, which is a small magazine about...
Thank you for joining us for this evening's discussion.
I mean, he's a better speaker than I am, but I don't know that the same speech twice is better than I am. No, thank you for being here. I'm the editor of America's Quarterly, which is a small magazine about Latin America. Our most recent issue was on the Amazon. So certainly touched on some of the issues that will be discussed here tonight. We have a great panel here with us. I'd like to give you brief introductions of them for full bios. I think that information is available. They're all experts in their field, and I won't do justice to their expertise here, but for the sake of expediency, I'll run through these quickly. To my left, Kate Horner is the Director of Forest Campaigns at the Environmental Investigation Agency. Nazi Ricciani is an associate professor and director of Latin American Studies and Political Science at Keene University and is the author of Systems of Violence, The Political Economy of War and Peace in Colombia, among other works. Kendra McSweeney is a professor of geography at Ohio State University with over 20 years of research on the relationship between indigenous peoples, forests, and conservation in Central America. And then Guillermo Ospina is a researcher and team leader on society and environment at the Comparative Social Studies Group in the University of Cauca in Colombia. So welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here. And I understand what we're going to do first is each of the speakers is going to give a short presentation of between 5 and 7 minutes. I will keep an eye on time and just will try to subtly signal you if we go over, because I know that I have questions and the audience has questions as well. So, Kate, if you'd like to start, we'll just move from right to left, if that's all right.
Sure.
Thank you all. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very grateful to the Open Society for giving me the chance to write this report, which it offered me an opportunity to get outside of Central America, where my expertise has been, and understand how what's going on in Central America is being replicated globally, particularly pantropically, within some of the most biodiverse landscapes of the world. Now, when you think about tropical rainforests, you think of biodiversity, and when you think of the threats to those environments, you think of oil palm, timber trafficking, deforestation broadly, loss of biodiversity, trade in animal parts, contamination associated with illicit gold mining, a host of environmental ills. And what I submit to you tonight is that in many instances, wherever you see drugs being trafficked or grown in these remote environments, you see all of these environmental ills also. And in fact, I would say that drug trafficking and drug cultivation are truly underappreciated drivers of some serious forms of environmental devastation. And that means that drug issues are very closely related to a host of things that we care about. As we know, climate change mitigation, securing indigenous people's rights, a host of rural development initiatives, conservation, and so on. And really, the purpose of this report is to acknowledge that, yes, indeed, it is drug traffickers and drug cultivators that are doing these things, that are cutting down the trees, moving the animals, converting the rainforest to cattle pasture. But we really want to draw attention to the fact that it is the international drug policy regime that must bear a large portion of the blame. And the question is why. I think Alex Soros really nicely laid out why eradication of drug crops simply leads to displacement of drug crop cultivators to new areas where they do, in fact, pioneer the opening up of new areas and the destruction often of protected areas, biosphere reserves, and indigenous territories. What is much less well recognized is the way in which environmental devastation is also being found in all the landscapes through which drugs are trafficked, where they're not being grown, simply the spaces through which they're being moved, which is what I'm seeing in Central America. We're going to hear about other transit spaces globally. Now, the key question is, why would the movement of drugs through a remote place lead to environmental devastation, and what has that got to do with international drug policy? And this is really the crux of the report, and that is to lay out the ways in which drug policy creates a foundation that, first of all, enriches traffickers and creates the context for them to invest in a host of illicit activities that are environmentally devastating. So the pillars of the drug policy, of the current drug control regime, are pretty much are predominantly supply-side approaches that include prohibition of drugs, we all know about that, eradication of drug crops, and then interdiction, which means the interception, the seizure, and surveillance and harassment of people moving drugs. Now, interdiction policies lead to environmental devastation, because the more traffickers get chased out of one place, the more they're just going to move into an even more remote space through which to operate. And those remote spaces happen to be indigenous territories and some of the most important protected areas in the world. The more they have to constantly relocate, the more they're constantly struggling between different drug trafficking organizations for control of key trafficking routes, which is a situation that leads to heightened violence and brings violence into these remote areas. And ultimately, by being chased around all the time, it allows traffickers to charge a higher risk premium, to make more money off of successfully delivering drugs to the next node in the drug commodity chain. And so the more they're hassled, the more money they make. And when they're making a lot of money, they've got to do something with it. And since it's dirty money, they've got to invest it in something quickly. They've got to launder that money. And what they're doing is laundering that money in frontier land speculation, converting tropical rainforest to cattle pasture, oil palm plantations, and other mono-agribusiness landscapes. They're seeing opportunity in trafficking in wildlife and timber that is in the areas into which they've been pushed. And so it is this prohibitionary regime that keeps drug prices high, and then it's the interdiction that allows traffickers to make a lot of money, which they then opportunistically launder in the environments, in the destruction of the environments into which they've been pushed. Now, I think, obviously, there's tremendous momentum building for drug policy reform, and I think now is really the moment to seize the window of opportunity to say, hey, let's rethink how we go about dealing with drug trafficking and drug crop eradication. How about easing up on these central pillars of conventional drug reform and think about new ways to approach the issue? And I'll leave it there so that we can discuss this more in the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm also grateful to the Open Society Foundation. The Environmental Investigation Agency is, as the name suggests, an environmental organization, so I'm particularly grateful for this opportunity to begin to knit together two communities that have maybe not interacted a great deal in the past. Just by way of introduction of how we come to this issue and how we think about it, we are an organization that's focused on ensuring good governance of natural resources in a sector that is rife with illegality. Over 70% of the wood harvested globally is done so illegally, and with huge impacts on local communities around the world. And those proceeds as well financing corruption in producer countries. What our research has shown unequivocally is that it's international demand that is driving that illicit activity in producer countries, with folks that we've investigated telling us time and time again, no buyer, no smuggling. That has then led to a recognition in international campaigns that consumer countries have a role to play in arresting these illicit networks. And also a recognition that traditional law enforcement in supply-side interventions wasn't working in the forest space. That led to the enactment of now laws in the US, Europe, and Australia that for the first time prohibited the import of illegally sourced wood products. And I understand that maybe prohibition has a slightly different connotation in this community than it does in the forest sector. But when we say prohibition, we really mean transforming a market that was historically no questions asked into one where there is now basic accountability for where you source from and the impact of your sourcing policies on sectors like the forest sector around the world. And as we have been investigating illegal logging around the world, we time and time again come up against the drug trade. And our first inclination for predominantly the safety and security of our staff is to put our heads down and ignore it as much as possible. And that's perhaps the first lesson to be learned, is that I think that there's a certain fear for those working in the field, the communities that are impacted by often very violent actors, of how to interact and how to provide information in a way that keeps them and their communities safe. As I was looking through this wonderful paper, our research largely confirms and reinforces much of the information that was presented. Certainly true, the role of crop substitution in as a function of drug policy efforts is driving deforestation. It's true not only in Colombia, certainly true in Peru, where we are seeing a massive explosion of oil palm. Most of that is done so illegally. Whether or not that's linked to drug traffickers is not something that we have found evidence of now, but certainly as a promotion of an alternative crop is certainly true. It's certainly true in Burma, where efforts to shift poppy production to alternative crops have driven household economies into further debt as they are forced into high input agricultural spaces that both deplete soil quality and put communities into debt, which has the function then of driving them further into frontier regions like forests to access quality soil, or it drives them back into illicit production because it's the only source of income that they have. Maybe I just wanted to talk about one new region that we've started looking in, which was perhaps covered in slightly less detail in the report, which is West Africa. We started looking at West Africa because we found that it was a new supply of a very high-value timber species of rosewood to China. China consumes the vast majority of the world's rosewood stocks, predominantly as a function of their rising middle class. When they, as a status symbol, they seek out reproduction Ming-style furniture that uses rosewood. The traditional supply of rosewood has come from Southeast Asia and from Madagascar. As efforts have been put in place to protect those species, we're seeing the supply shift to new regions. So in 2012 and 2013, we started seeing large volumes of export of rosewood from across the West African region. And it started in Guinea-Bissau in 2011, 2012. And what was particularly interesting and perhaps relevant for this community is that the biggest spike of rosewood happened directly following, in the 2 months following, a DEA enforcement effort of the major drug traffickers in Guinea-Bissau. And there were two actors that were predominantly controlling the trade. It was the naval admiral and the general of the army. Obviously, the man in charge of the Navy was controlling routes, the sea routes, lots of mangrove forests, lots of access by sea. And on the land routes, because during colonial times it was a typical vacation spot, lots of airstrips and lots of access points on land. And those two actors were vying for control of the trade in Guinea-Bissau. In the sting effort, the general of the army did not actually get on the boat to take it out to international waters, where the DEA eventually arrested the man in charge of the Navy, Bobo. And following the increased scrutiny of the cocaine smuggling from West Africa through to Europe, the network simply shifted then to rosewood. And that's when you saw the largest spikes of rosewood. There are very strong indications that it's the same actors that are controlling the trade. Local actors say that rosewood and cocaine are cousins. They're the same actors, the same people. We have yet to see that. I don't honestly know what's happening now with the cocaine routes, but one can presume that there's a certain elasticity between those illicit trades where you have, as scrutiny of cocaine perhaps declines, you might have increased cocaine trafficking, but essentially provided an opportunity for illicit networks to maintain their supply routes with a new commodity. I will wrap up because I'm probably towards the end of my time. I guess I wanted to say, as a reflection from those of us from perhaps outside the sector, that the resistance that I see in this community to hypercriminalization and evidence of the futility of eradication efforts bears some resemblance to the illegal logging campaigns of old that were typically focused on supply-side interventions and targeting the local actors that were particularly engaged in subsistence deforestation for local uses. And as we've now shifted to the demand side of the equation, where it shifts the accountability matrix quite substantially and provides an opportunity for local actors to better assert their rights. So perhaps I will stop there. Again, I'm grateful for the opportunity to engage in this discussion, and hopefully it will lead to more productive bridge building across the environmental communities and the drug policy community. Thanks.
Good evening. Let me start with the conclusions, since we don't have much time. So breaking with conventional wisdom, I will start by presenting three overarching conclusions reached by our preliminary research, and then list three core nodal points, followed by some observations drawn from the Colombian case, which is the focus of my own research. The first overarching conclusion is narco-traffickers or narco-trafficking is great for capitalism since it's generating both capital and accumulation, but is harmful to sustainable development, the environment, and public health. Second overarching conclusion, narco-traffickers are par excellence laissez-faire free marketeers with the capacity of enforcing contracts and protecting their gains since they cannot solely depend on the state protection. In some cases, they do depend on state protection as well through corruption and all the cases actually where narco-trafficking operates. The third overarching conclusion is narco-trafficking proceeds did not create but reinforce trends such as transforming land usage and food productive from productive ends to speculation, cattle ranching, agribusiness, mining, and services. There are three interdependent dimensions that reinforce, actually three or nodal points, if you wish, of the political economy of narco-trafficking pertinent to our research agenda. The first one is the production side and the environmental damage that is caused by the triangle of coca plantations, cocaine production, and the strategies of fumigation and eradication or the drug enforcing regimes or the drug fighting regimes, such as the ones deployed in Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia, and others. And secondly, which is maybe the most complex aspect of the whole narco-trafficking problematic, is the cascading effects of narco-trafficking on socioeconomic, political impact, ecological transformation, caused by the repatriation of the narco-dollars or the narco-dollars generated from cocaine selling in global markets. This is, I think, the most complex aspect of the problem. And then finally, the collateral environmental damage in transit points. Now, there are two components of the problematic, the direct and the what I call the cascading. Let me just to sketch the direct impact of narco-trafficking. A simple arithmetic exercise can give us some idea of the relationship between direct and cascading effects. In Colombia, for instance, the areas impacted the most by coca plantation and its movement were calculated in 2009 to be 68,000 hectares, which is about 0.1% of the country's area. From my first look, this is not significant, right? 0.1. It's not very important. But the second look, at which we studied its shifts and changes in areas of cultivation, a more sovereign figure emerged. That is, more than 400,000 hectares were affected by coca plantations at one given point between 2001 and 2006. And as some experts claim, if you add to these 409,000 hectares, 1 kilometer, basically UNDOC, what they did at the exercise, for every hectare, they add one addition, 1 kilometer around the hectare that is affected by the coca plantations. So therefore, according to the UNDOC calculations, that brings us to a staggering figure of 12.4 million hectares in Colombia were impacted by the coca plantations over until 2008. Now, this latter figure represents 10% of the national territory of Colombia. So now we're talking about this is the direct. Now, since we're talking about cascading, the narco-bourgeoisie who transferred to Colombia roughly circa $47 billion between the years of 1981 and 2009. from which 16 billion were repatriated between 2000 and 2009. Ironically, that was during the peak of the so-called Plan Colombia, which amounted to less than 10 billion. So narco-traffickers were contributing more than the US-funded Plan Colombia to Colombia. I don't know if contributing, but let me use this term problematically. The narco-bourgeoisie funds were invested in various sectors, chiefly in acquiring lands and real estate, stimulating macroeconomic trends, including speculative and land bubble, which basically I'm looking at, my research is looking actually at how land prices have been increasing in Colombia for the last 10 or 15 years, which is again disrupting the rural economy and impacting food production and food security in the country. Now it's not only to mention rural employment and distorting the allocation of resources and, of course, the levels of the conflict. Now, the total figures, just to give you an idea, between cascading and direct. Now we need to add to these figures the other cascading effects, which is cattle ranching, illegal mining, expansion of agribusiness, and the illegal wool trade that were mentioned before in the presentations. A great part were either stimulated or spearheaded by the narco-bourgeoisie. The surface area impacted could reach as high as 20 million hectares, a figure that is, it's a work in progress that will require, further validation. I'm looking at how we could really, according to my initial research, I think we are, this figure is the most plausible about the damage, direct and cascading, in terms of the environment. I think I will stop here. And maybe with the Q&A, we can further develop these themes. Thank you.
Thank you. Guillermo.
Yes, thank you. Okay, thanks all for coming. I will try to talk in English. The first thing that I must say is thanks a lot, Cassia, and all the team in the Open Society Foundations for inviting me. And permits that I have this amazing week learning here about something really that one thing that I don't know. I have an idea what this works in this side of the large change of the drugs, and this is about harm reduction. This is an amazing week learning about that because I know a little bit about from the to the another side. Of the change in which the drugs is produced, mainly the raw material to the drugs production. And this is the another side when the people use, some people use drugs. And this is two very different realities. I know some aspects of the places in which there are production of raw materials to the elaboration of drugs. And the main idea that I want leave here is that after that part in the drugs production, behind that there are families, humans, there are people working the land, and they have the coca crop or poppy crops as part of their familiar production. It's one cultivation more that support the family's incomes in the fields when the people grow those plants, because we are talking about a plant. It's not sometimes people talk about cocaine fields or crops, I don't understand what it means, because if I answer, for example, in the botanical garden about coca plants, the manager can ask me, are you asking about cocaine? No, I'm not asking about cocaine. I'm asking about coca plant, because it's a plant, like poppy. Poppy is another plant. But cocaine and morphine or heroin is another matter. But in the fields where people grow that plants, there are another realities. Mainly it's related with poor people looking for an opportunity to get an income in their domestic economy. And here, for example, in the war or the reality of users, I call my attention that usually people don't know from where or from what kind of context is coming from that substance that are using. For example, about poppies, some people that I talk in the, for example, in Washington Eight Corners Project is a very interesting case. I try to talk with people about, okay, what do you think about that substance that you need to use or whatever? And people say, oh, yeah, the heroin comes from the leaves of a plant. And so I say, okay, but it's not from leaves. It's another. It's a flower. And this flower have sounds like a sphere. And from their part of the plant come from the latex. But they say, really? But I don't know. But it's amazing. I thought that it was from a leaf. It's in the case of coca. Cocaine comes from a large process from the leaf as material, raw material. But I think that there are two different realities, very different realities, so distant realities. But it's important to work in connect, because there are similar aspects, even though the differences of context, because the urban and industrial context like Manhattan is so different of the growers in the countryside of Colombia or Peru or Afghanistan or Burma, etc. So there are different realities there. The important matter is to be clear that there are people, it's human beings behind this matter of discussion related with drugs. So my main interest as anthropologist and PhD student have been about the people living in national parks. National parks is, maybe it's not the same here in USA, but it's some kind of protect area. It's one category of protect area, like national forests or another. And in these areas, the idea of protect areas is that people have not the space there. So it's one kind of spaces to nature protection. But the reality shows that in many national parks and other protect areas, there are people living there. So it's real that there are people living in protect areas, and the direct effect of that situation is that people, some kind of people, because not all people, some kind of people is defined as an object of intervention. It's people that not must to be there. It's people considered an object of replacement or of the reubication. In the case of indigenous people, it's considered as part of the conservation areas. Moreover, indigenous people is considered a conservation object as at the same level of natural objects. But in the case of people that is not indigenous, what people is not indigenous? For example, peasant, I don't know, the word is in French or in English, I don't know, but it's peasantry people. And in the case of peasantry people, the relationship with protect areas and national park in particular is so different, because these people is considered as illicit in national parks. It's people that not have a space there, because it's a space for conservation nature, yeah. So my main interest in this aspect of people living or dwelling, inhabiting in national parks, is what is the relationship between there and the land use, for example. Yeah. Land use is considered illegal, and land property considered illegal also. And these people lives in a situation of marginalization because it's considered as illegal. Sometimes it happened that in national parks live people that was there in that place before the declaratory or the statement of the national park. And that produced an incompatibility to resolve, but it's not easy to solve that. So the problem increased or the situation is increasing in the critic mass when we find in national parks moreover people that as peasantries shifting or cultivating coca or poppies. So it's illegal people because live there in a place where supposed it's not people, it's just nature. But moreover, these people is growing coca or poppies like a part of their livelihood system because these chiefs or cultivations make part of the domestic or familiar economy like an income in cash that is not comparable with another products like, for example, plátano or banana or yuca or whatever other plant. So this is one part, the land uses. Studying land uses in national parks, we find the relationship between this and the land tenure systems. And this is more interesting even because land use and land tenure systems are directly related, but not always is explicitly or clear in the cadastral surveys or in that kind of files to understand how the state think the situation of people living in national parks and protect areas. And moreover, related with land uses like illicit crops and production of raw materials to the drugs production. This is the wide context of my work in Colombia. But related with another presentation is the question in deep is what happened after land is abandoned for the pressures of drugs policies, because people is moving and displaced and pushed more and more beyond for the drugs policies, looking for new lands because there are people poisoned for aerial spread of glyphosate or Roundup or that things. So what happened with the land that people live when moving to new lands? This is one of the main questions, and the time ends.
Well, no, but okay. let's come back to that because you've, as many of our panelists have, you've in the process of answering many questions, you've raised many questions as well. Mm-hmm. So, what I'd like to do now is move to sort of a moderated discussion, and everybody on the panel should feel free to jump in as they want. We'll do that for about 20, 30 minutes or so, and then there are many of you here, and we'd like to open up after that the floor to your questions as well. And my first question is targeted towards Kendra and Nazi specifically. Beyond the ways that we've talked about already tonight, what are some of the less obvious ways in which the current international drug policy results in environmental destruction? I mean, we've talked a little bit about palm oil. But what else is there that's sort of less visible to those of us, living in cities, whether it's in cities in Latin America or in places like New York?
Thanks for that. I think probably, in general, this issue is kind of overlooked. I think people get the idea that where drugs are cultivated and then eradicated, that creates a situation where farmers simply move deeper into the forest. I think that's something we sort of understand. I think the dynamic that is least well understood, as I mentioned, is the way in which drug trafficking zones become sites of real environmental devastation. And so I think it's great that Kate brought up West Africa, because drug trafficking zones under the current drug policy regime are proliferating. So the DEA, together with the Mexican government, push, well, let's go back. Plan Colombia is successful in decartelizing Colombia and breaking apart the big cartels. So operations move to Mexico. Then in 2006, the Mexican government decides to crack down on drug cartels there. So they start to they stop receiving drugs in into Mexico, and they start moving operations further south into first Guatemala, then Honduras. Now they're being chased out of Honduras by the Honduran military, backed by the DEA and Southcom and others, and moving into Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and so on. And things are getting a little too hot for moving drugs through the Caribbean and Central America. Well, let's start moving drugs through West Africa. This is the cocaine trade, obviously, and so on. And so the emergence of West Africa as a cocaine trafficking hub is the direct result of prior crackdowns in other areas. And so what I call in the report this relentless cat and mouse game is going nowhere. It's simply smearing the problem around the globe. And I think that's something, and trafficking zones are these spaces where when traffickers are pushed into these areas, they wreak havoc. And in urban areas, we know that it's the gangs that typically embody the chaos that reigns, but it's the problem is very much a rural problem, too, because as traffickers operate through these remote areas, they don't miss any opportunities, being the good capitalists that they are. They miss absolutely no opportunities to benefit from speculative land markets and so on. And as Nancy so nicely said, because they have cash and because they have violence at their disposal, they operate sometimes with complete impunity. So it's very easy to open a speculative land market in the middle of a biosphere reserve if you can pay off every inspector and you can create a landscape of such violence that nobody will rat you out. And so that's what we're seeing, is sort of drug traffickers acting as perhaps the pioneers in opening up what were formerly protected spaces to international capital, investments in things like cattle and in oil palm, which are good ways to launder money. They're also good long-term investments, they're good long-term investments for anyone, including drug traffickers. So, but drug traffickers are creating this wonderful investment climate in some of the last and best rural frontiers. And this is happening across the globe. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. Nazi, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. Actually, maybe we should open a very serious debate about the drug fighting regime itself. Because, in fact, the reason why narco-trafficking is a very good business is simply because of the prohibition. So in other words, if we continue under that ceiling, this is an endless war that will stay with us for another 300 years. Okay. So the logic of because what we need to do is, first and foremost, legalize drugs in order to eliminate the incentives of that business. As long as the drug regime, fighting regime exists, under this regime, actually, it's a futile effort to think about all the cascading events. If I were to accept that there is little we can do about changing or legalizing drugs, then the second recommendation could be, at least the lax financial system here in the West in the industrial nations is where basically most of the drug money is being channeled back to the different West Africa or to Colombia and Central America and Mexico. So therefore, the laxity in the financial system here, including in the United States, is partially responsible for the whole drug problem. So either way, either you reform, or if you want to continue this policing strategy, although that I know that it's futile, and it will lead nowhere. But if you want to really fight them, fight the drug thing, at least develop a more efficient financial oversight in order to control the money laundering operations that happens basically here. Most of the money, most of the proceeds of the money remain here, meaning in the West. And just a fraction goes back to Central America, to Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, and elsewhere. So if we are, if we need to be candid, we need to be honest about the problematic. But I think the real solution is by changing the whole drug fighting regime, by legalizing drugs. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you know, that leads into my next question, which is really for the whole panel, which is, you know, is there some sort of, I mean, beyond the merits of the drug legalization debate, which I think is something that we could have a whole separate debate or series of debates about, is there any middle ground short of that? I mean, are there policies within a framework where, you know, there was still drug interdiction? Are there policies that could potentially make a difference on the environmental side of this? Or is legalization just the necessary precondition here?
Well,
go for it.
Good luck.
I will say again, I'm not a drug policy expert. We come to this from looking at monitoring environmental crime. I guess what I would say is certainly the crop substitution policies that privilege and have a strong preference to input-intensive agriculture that is imposed on communities profoundly undermines both rural economies and sovereignty and rights and puts those communities into long-term debt that they have nowhere else to turn but illicit economies. So I think that there are extraordinary lessons to be learned from the agricultural campaigns that are trying to support agroecological approaches that allow communities to define their agricultural systems in a way that lifts up and upholds indigenous peoples and local communities' knowledge and supports their food sovereignty objectives. I think that that's one. From a relatively neophyte perspective, I think that the focus on eradication that sees communities as primarily a locus of illegality seems very familiar to the illegal logging world, where there has been a blindness to the role of transnational corporations in deforesting. And largely out of convenience, there was an attempt to target and criminalize local actors for entering into the forest largely for subsistence means. And that means that they are then blind to the larger forces at work that that are primarily responsible for motivating the impacts on the forest. And certainly undermines, I mean, the difference, I think it's, is it Bolivia that I think that's allowed for some degree of coca cultivation in deference to the traditional uses of coca. And I think that that is also an important lesson. It's an inconvenient one, but one that allows for communities to define their own approaches to production of whatever it is, I think is one that seems reasonable to me. One last thing that I would just say of approaches that seem to work is from looking at other illicit networks, I certainly see the value in targeting financial flows. What you will see in the United States is that the Department of Justice is particularly eager to use legal avenues like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the anti-money laundering statutes, particularly for politically exposed persons in the wake of 9/11. And leaving aside the Department of Justice political motivation, that means that we will fall upon friendly ears with some of this information. I would be interested to know more about how actors in the drug policy community are monitoring financial flows. It's certainly one that we find very difficult, but efforts to increase corporate transparency is something that I think would be an important middle ground, because it would allow you to more effectively track the money. Because what we see is that you clamp down on one illegal actor, they simply set up a shell corporation, that benefits the same companies. It just has a different name. It's just really hard to track that because we don't have any transparency in corporate records.
I think those are great points. I mean, I really don't think there's a magic bullet here. We're talking about digging ourselves out of a morass that we've dug ourselves into over 40, 50 years of conventional drug policy. And I think it'll take a host of different creative solutions to dig ourselves out of it. But I think beginning that journey has to begin with recognition that we have effectively, in the global north, outsourced dealing with the drug problem to countries of the global north by locating the pathologies of the war on drugs as pathologies inherent to these nations. So Colombia is somehow pathological. Central America does it, you know, has poor governance. You know, these are created, the problems in these countries, in West Africa, you know, rogue nations, failed states, these are states that are bearing the burden for our outdated, very 20th century drug policies. And so to go after them is fundamentally to blame the victim. And I think spaces have to be opened up within the multilateral drug policy community to cede space to these countries of the Global South who have been most affected by these policies, to suggest new ways to begin to reorient drug policy in a way so that the users of drugs bear the majority of the burden for dealing with the drug issue. I think when I talk to people in Central America, what they say is, how about taking the money that you're spending chasing fast boats around the Caribbean and put it into rural governance? How about putting it into reinforcing the protected areas? How about putting it into land titling for indigenous people? How about putting it into a host of issues that get totally neglected in our stubborn pursuit of traffickers? And so I think there are all kinds of opportunities for inventive new drug policies. Bolivia, Uruguay are doing really interesting things. They're finding their own way to do it, and it's working for them. I think these baby steps are what we should be looking at and learning from.
You know, I lived in Latin America for 10 years and in different countries. And in the producer countries, as well as the consumer countries, and I spent these last 5 years living in Brazil, which is, of course, now the world's, by some measures, the world's biggest consumer of cocaine. You really get the feeling that you're just going up against a tidal wave of drug money, that these governments really struggle and maybe just don't have the resources to compete against. The kinds of measures that you're talking about, I mean, even things like sponsoring land titles, for example, which seems to me like sensible policy. I mean, do those just get swallowed up again at the end of the day by this seemingly infinite reservoir of cocaine-related money? That's for you, Kendra.
Yes. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of policy displacement to chasing traffickers and cracking down on urban drug gangs. And so that money has to come from somewhere, and it usually comes out of, you know, community development, rural development programs. But sometimes that redirection of national monies is not a domestic, is not driven by domestic decisions. It's being driven by international players who put tremendous pressure on countries to do that. I mean, if we allow a little thought experiment here, let's say tomorrow the DEA, Southcom, and all the other sort of enablers of drug interdiction just stop for a little while, and the trafficking routes solidify, and the risk premiums go down, so the traffickers make less money and they fix their routes and don't wander around into new areas, I think you would see a marked reduction in the sort of environmental harms that we're seeing. And I think you'd buy some breathing room for the sort of alternative strategies like improved forest governance, pursuit of indigenous rights, REDD+ programs to protect carbon stocks and so on. I think you give those programs a space to operate, a little room, a little breathing room. So that's my answer.
Better quality cocaine.
And you'd get better quality. I mean, why not fair trade cocaine? I mean, seriously.
This question is for Guillermo. You know, you've studied the effects of conflict on the environment and natural resources, and specifically in Colombia. Are you hopeful at all that the current peace process underway could help mitigate some of those effects?
I have translation support here, and I want to use it.
Oh, okay. No, the question is, puedo hablar en español también, pero no quiero desrespetar al público aquí porque no sé si todos aquí hablan español. Todos hablan español. Será. I doubt it. I'll ask it again in English, and you can translate. The question is, you know, you have studied the relationship between conflict and environmental damage. Are you hopeful about the consequences of the current peace process in Colombia and the way that that can mitigate some of these environmental costs?
I just want to be sure about the question.
Of course.
It's very important.
Of course.
It's very important. It's, the first is that process, that peace process in La Habana, is a national proud. I don't know, proud is the word?
A source of pride.
Pride.
Yeah. Un orgullo nacional, right?
Yes. No, it's not el orgullo. No es el orgullo. Es como the hope of all the nation, mm-hmm. You know? Because, for example, I don't know my country in peace. I always had lived in a country with an internal conflict for more than 15 years. I had 40. And I don't know a country in peace. And it's a dream if this country get the peace because it's amazing. It's an amazing country. But I don't know. There are a lack of trust in the population because it's a long time. You know, it's almost like a habit. It's the routinary violence. It's not just about the FARC or the big armed groups like guerrillas, FARC or ELN or another smaller. It's beyond that. It's about the criminal organizations, even though the government, the corruption in the state is amazing, is incredible. So the peace process agreement to have two aspects or two points directly related with the subject or the issue in the table. And the first one is the land reform. Land reform in Colombia is a promise, but it's a promise that no one government had completed, achieved. Because land in the deep of the Colombian conflict, land is the gasoline, is the matter. After all, beyond drugs is another. Drugs support part, but after all, it's the land. Mm-hmm. Land is the main concern in the internal conflict. So the first point is land reform, but the question is how. Redistribution of land, because so few people have a lot of extension of lands, and the most of population is without land or have just little pieces of land, and in the most of cases tenure is just an occupation.
Right.
Is it an irregularity or I don't know which is the word, but.
Pero yo preguntaba también por los efectos medioambientales, ¿no? Si puede tener alguna consecuencia positiva
Sí.
Para el medio ambiente.
Okay, okay. Para allá voy entonces. El tercer punto, the third point of the agenda, of the agreement, is related with drugs production, because FARC is considered one of the biggest cartels of traffickers in the world, but it's the revolutionary group, but it's a capitalist group in this moment. It's like a multinational getting incomes, using what they want, extortioning people or sequestering, kidnapping or trafficking with cocaine or something like that, or just trafficking with people, because when displaced people or kill people is one kind of use people like an object in that perverse system of production. But of course, the agreement will have an environmental effect. But I think that the effect would be, I'm not an expert in violentologist or conflictology or something like that, but yes, the effect is when the people to get or to have the possibility to return to their lands, because there are a lot of people who was displaced from their lands for violence. If people have the opportunity to return or go back, of course, we'll use again lands abandoned for 20 or 30 years. So that impact will be clear. Maybe in this moment, some people talk about the forest in Colombia, for example, gain space in the last 20 years. The recover, the forest recover in the country. But if people get or to have the opportunity to work in the countryside, in the lands, it's almost sure that the land cover change again into agricultural lands. This is possible. And illicit crops, consider illicit crops, it's possible that growth also. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nazi, do you have anything to add to that? I mean, does a peace deal make any material difference in drug production in Colombia? Because I have to confess my own doubts on that one. I mean, I understand the historical aspect of it, but it seems based on some of the arguments that we've been hearing tonight that really it that production just shifts elsewhere and the core problem remains the same.
Thank you. Actually, the Colombia, again, is producing or planting more coca this year than the previous year. So therefore, coca production has increased. Peru assumed the first position, and then Colombia retook it again 2014. If we take the last year, this year, 2014, according to the latest statistics from the Department, National Development Planning Department, the figures is that this year alone, the deforestation in Colombia increased by 16%, 16.16%, 2014. And this is while there is a ceasefire between the FARC and the government, and the ELN is about to commence its peace talks with the Colombian government. From my own field research in the Department of META this summer, I noticed that whatever space is left by the FARC is being occupied by PARC military groups. So therefore, I don't think, given this current situation, I do not expect that the deforestation nor the coca production will decline with the signature of the peace agreement next year.
It sounds like it. You're saying it may continue to increase.
Correct. Or at least I would not expect it to decrease anytime soon. What is needed in Colombia, and not only in Colombia, maybe in the remaining, in the Andean region, and maybe also in Central America, is rethinking the economic models of development, at least reactivate the rural economies, creating new incentives for the peasants to shift from legal to legal. But at the same time, if we don't see any changes here in terms of the drug fighting regime, this is not, it's a futile thing, really. We have to take it very seriously to change. I mean, this regime, as long as it's in place, drug trafficking will continue and we keep fighting the mouse and cat type of thing. So it is a futile war, endless, and the drug traffickers are smart people. They have the incentives to do it. They make lots of money, billions of dollars. So you have to eliminate incentives for the whole drug economy. Now, in case of Colombia, as I said, the solution, of course, it depends on how serious is the government to implement, first and foremost, the land reform. Secondly, now the government is pushing for something called the CEDAR, which is basically opening new frontiers, and this is a very dangerous thing. New frontiers in areas that could be deforested under legal protection of the state as new zones that will allow free investments, unmitigated investments of agribusinesses, and transforming peasants, subsistence peasantry, into actually not sharecroppers, but basically into agrarian workers. And they're pushing the legislation as we speak today in the Congress. Actually, it might be approved anytime. If this is going to happen, then this the thing about the CEDARs is that will include public lands, which is forested, and therefore the government will be legalizing the deforestation, and consequently, it has a very grave environmental impact. And so therefore, the thing is how the Colombian government is going to revise its economic policies, its economic future plans. Now, this is critical to understand. And please watch it. If any one of you is watching the Colombian thing, look at CEDARs, ZIDER. Thank you.
I guess the challenge comes in, and after this question, I want to open things up to the audience. I guess the challenge becomes, I mean, I don't think anyone doubts that a major change in drug policy in both these countries and the United States as a whole, I mean, it's clear that that would produce a radical paradigm change in these problems that we're talking about. There's been, the debate has shifted here in the United States substantially in the last 10 years in ways that many of us did not think was possible with what's been done in Colorado and in other places. But that's just marijuana, right? And it's hard for me, and I analyze Latin American politics. I don't analyze U.S. politics for a living, but I am American. It's hard for me to see a scenario in the next 10 years under which cocaine, for example, could be legalized. And so then you find yourself asking, well, gosh, you know, 10 years is a really long time. And so what can be done between now and then to kind of mitigate the effects of some of the problems that we're discussing here? We've touched on this a bit, but is there anything else kind of in that middle ground that we have not talked about yet that could make a difference? Yes, of course.
I think that's a great question. And I think the answer lies in what's going to happen in at the UN here in New York in April. So the UN General Assembly will be discussing drug policy reform, and member states will be present. And it will be a wonderful opportunity to first acknowledge the many and varied collateral damages associated with conventional drug policy, of which the environment is one that I would argue has been overlooked. And one of the things, one of these sort of intermediate measures, is to turn to the communities within the UN and beyond that are dedicated to environmental protection, to indigenous rights, and to rural development, and talk to them about how their work is made so much more difficult by the prohibitionary zeal that is endorsed under the UN's Office of Drugs and Crime. So in other words, perhaps within the UN, we can see a kind of rapprochement between these agencies that work in complete, appear from the ground to be working in a high degree of isolation from one another, and begin to talk about how drug policy affects the work of other UN agencies. Because right now, you've got the UN Office of Drugs and Crime creating a climate that fundamentally undermines the goals championed by other agencies of the UN, particularly the UN RED program that's about reducing deforestation and degradation, the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous People, the UN Development Program, and the UN Environment Program. They have really not had a substantive way to shape drug policy. And now is the time for that conversation to begin. And I think that is the space from which new and interesting policies will emerge. I wouldn't presume to suggest what they would be, but those are the people who should be talking about them. And they should be talking about them as equals at a common table. Thanks.
No, maybe an outlandish idea is to start for governments importing cocaine directly, meaning and see the usage of cocaine for medical ends. So therefore, if the Western Europe, European Union, the United States, and Japan, and the major industrial nations will embark on a project of themselves importing cocaine, and therefore try to see because, you know, in the 19th century, early 20s, actually they experimented with cocaine here, and therefore it was used for medical purposes. So it's not a very outlandish idea if you look at the history of cocaine and cocaine production. The thing is, if you want to think outside the box, meaning outside the drug fighting regime, we need to think above it and below it and about it. So therefore, we need to look at the different dimensions, how we could really reach a solution for this endemic, unending fight. So maybe the idea, therefore, what about suggesting in an international forum about governments starting to absorb the production of cocaine and maybe look for the usage of this in the medical usage and other usages that could be thought of. So basically, suggest an idea.
I suppose the, from my perspective of working with colleagues on the ground and those that live in and depend upon the forest for their resources, I think one of the things that we've seen in supporting them and their activism is that to be a defender of land and the environment puts you immediately in peril. And I think, as was noted earlier, that this is fundamentally about land, any way you look at it. And so I would say that in addition to the very important policy conversations that are taking place as we shift to away from some of these failed policies, I think there needs to be increased attention to how to ensure the safety and security of those that are on the front lines of this fight. And I think that there's a lot of work that could be done. From my perspective, I think that the work that's taken place in Colombia about providing additional protective services to those under threat is, in my view, unparalleled in the world. I'm not sure of another institution that has those state-provided services. I think there are a lot of other actions that need to be taken. I think we need to increase the awareness of people under threat. But I would say maybe that as a corollary to some of the additional points that were made about increased sovereignty in economic development strategies, particularly in the agricultural space, is one that urgently needs to be deployed, and one where I think you would find a great number of friendly allies to join the stakeholders.
Okay, well, thank you. I have to admit, for this next part, I'm not quite sure how we're going to do this. Do we have a microphone that members in the audience can use, or we'll ask them to come up here? Is that right? Or, you know, this is a small enough room where I think, I'm sorry, it's being webcast. All right, well, please, if you have a question that you'd like to ask, please address yourself to the microphone. You had pole position on that one, so that's on now.
So a comment and a question. So What I think where the topic of the presentation is the impact of cocaine prohibition on the environment, because I think that's what you're really talking about, and I wish you would say that because it feels, to be honest, it feels somewhat manipulative to hear it described as the impact of drug policy and to say drug policy. If Open Society is advocating for cocaine legalization, I think it should just say so. And what I think the paper that you've put out is saying is that cocaine prohibition is having a negative impact on the environment, and that your hope is that at the UN General Assembly that you're going to be able to point to the environmental impact as one of the arguments against cocaine prohibition. And again, if that is what your the purpose, I'd like you to be a little more clear about that.
That's certainly what I've gotten out of tonight.
Right, that's what I think we're
but please, what's your question?
And if that, so here's the question. If that is what you're saying, then I imagine your position is that cocaine legalization is good for the environment. And if that is what you're saying, could you tell us why that would be the case? Because, and then just a question as well for Kate. Kate, tell me if I'm wrong, but the impact that legal businesses are having on the environment may actually dwarf the impact of drug prohibition. I think I hear you saying that we need a better regulatory response to protect our forests and to help the planet, not a deregulation effort. I don't really hear you saying that legalizing cocaine will protect our forests. And when you think about the impact that legal corporations or multinational corporations are having on climate change and on the environment, it's hard for me to understand how legalizing cocaine helps our environment.
Okay, thank you. Who wants to start?
Well, thanks very much for that provocation. I think you've pulled out a really good point about the report. And the fact is, the idea was to bring together the science that shows us that current drug policies are having unexpectedly negative impacts on the environment. And the majority of that research has, you're quite right, the bulk of the research on that link has been done in spaces that happen to be along the cocaine commodity chain, but not exclusively. The report cites spaces of opium, poppy production, and marijuana also. We happen to be using the case of cocaine because it's one that we're most familiar with, and it's one that is, in many respects, closest to home because it's concentrated in the Western Hemisphere. But what the processes we're talking about are absolutely mirrored in the global opium trade, in that is also a significant, that is very significant in the Western Hemisphere also, but in the Golden Triangle and India. And so I apologize if the takeaway for you is that we're simply talking about cocaine. We're talking about all licit, grade A, whatever they're called, Schedule I narcotics here. And any that are cultivated, that is. And so we're talking also about marijuana production in California's national parks, in the Blue Ridge Mountains, in all across the United States. The same dynamics are at work. This report does not advocate for cocaine legalization. What it advocates for, and I thank Nasi for bringing that up, because is cocaine legalization inevitably where this discussion leads? Absolutely not. Who knows where it will lead? I think it would be irresponsible to say because trees are falling along the cocaine commodity chain, we must legalize it. Absolutely not. That would be reckless. I think what I certainly am advocating for is that all of the countries that are enrolled in the cocaine or the opium or the marijuana commodity chains that are suffering greatly due to, I would say, very misguided policies, be allowed to have a much greater say in how they want the this fundamentally economic activity to be regulated and to open up the policy spaces for discussion. Now, if the global policy discussion moves towards legalization of particular drugs, so be it. But that is not what we are advocating, I am advocating for here. This discussion has never really made it to any big multilateral table, and the time to talk about it is now. That is what is being advocated for here.
May I?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand the word advocacy, and it's a very interesting word. I try to understand the practice of people here, working hard here, with the users of drugs. And I agree with you. My propose or my aim is not work for advocacy of cocaine legalization. But I'm interested in the decriminalization of the producers, because it's peasantry people working the land to get an income in their domestic economies, and decriminalization of users. Because it's people that is not criminal people. There exist different kind of drugs, and cocaine and heroin is the classic drugs. But what happened with the diversity of synthetic drugs that they are producing in the garage or in the basement? Or there are people producing that. The matter or the issue of decriminalization or legalization or any kind of drug is what happens if everyone can produce drug and trade with that. I don't know. This is a very futuristic scenario, or maybe so close that we think about. But it's just that comment.
Well, let me, if you'll permit me, and I want to go to the next question, but. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
I was excited.
Okay.
It's totally valid to raise the point about the question of comparing the legal logging and illicit drug trafficking. Just to clarify, when I talk about the role of demand-side policies to address illegal logging, what we are fundamentally trying to do is make the laws of the producer country matter in international trade, because historically they haven't. It's been a no-questions-asked market. And what that means then is that transnational organized crime has a disproportionate impact on natural resource governance, anti-corruption efforts. And that's not to say that that all logging is good. But the fact that the laws on the books have been so fundamentally undermined by transnational organized crime in the logging sector is what is trying to be addressed. And that, I think, maybe leads to the second point, which, at least when I think about some of the impacts of drug policy that we see in the field, it's the imposition of an agenda from outside that undermines economic development strategies, particularly through the crop substitution policies. And the imposition of that agenda from outside, the undermining of natural resource governance at a country level, at a community level, by external actors, is part of the impact that I think is so damaging at the country level and at the community level.
Okay, thank you. Sorry for almost stepping on your answer there. I wanted to ask, and maybe you would like to come up to the microphone while I ask this follow-up question that's essentially coming back to one of the questions you asked, which I've just, the polemicist in me found provocative, which is, would a world in which cocaine in particular was legalized inflict less environmental damage upon these areas that we've been discussing today?
I'll be very brief. I think it would be dangerous to speculate. It absolutely will depend on how those laws would be implemented and by whom. So to get back to Kate's point, if that is a bottom-up solution that is proposed by transit nations, that's one thing. If it's a top-down, if it's enacted as a top-down policy that comes at great cost, then it wouldn't work. So I think we cross that bridge when we come to it.
Mazi?
I think it's mea culpa that I opened this debate, really. So it's my full responsibility. the reason why the whole purpose is to really start thinking outside the box. It's not really... the thing is about if you eliminate prohibition, you can police better. Look at what happened, for instance, when the alcohol was prohibited, right? And the prohibition of alcohol in the United States produced counterproductive thing, produces the mafia here, right? And then eventually when alcohol was legalized, then we can police more the consumption of alcohol. Applying the same logic, we could use it also for cocaine, so why not? So the thing is, we have to devise, we know that we've been fighting against this war against drugs and had costed billions of dollars and maybe trillions now. We have, I don't know how many agencies in the United States, about 26 agencies fighting this war on drugs, which is futile. And we've been fighting it for almost 30 years plus now. So it's time to start reflecting how effective was this policy and what is it leading to. So if we are shy of saying legalization or decriminalization or thinking outside the box, I don't think this will solve the issue. So the thing is to start thinking outside the box, okay? Now, if you legalize, and I repeat, if you legalize, you can police. And therefore, not only police protecting the environment, is part of the policing and where to do that. Because at the end of the day, coca is a cash crop like any other cash crop, right? So therefore, planting this cash crop at the expense of food production, for instance, cannot be permitted in terms of a sustainable economic development. So we need to balance it out. But we cannot do that except if we have legalization to police it and to control it. So that's the entry point. That's why I suggested it as a mean to open a discussion. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Hello, my name is Paul Gilman. I'm with the Green Party in New York, and we do advocate an end to the drug war. And, you know, you're talking about how the West African states, their laws aren't respected by the international community or multinationals, but those states in West and East Africa are pretty much in the service of international capitalism, and they're not meant to be respected by international capital. So the only way to combat that would be a mass movement, because I don't expect top-down policy change to really change anything. We need a mass movement. And with that, I've on a personal level, I've been studying the rise of the narco-bourgeois in Mexico as a challenge to international capital, to their hegemony. And it's not like they're any better, but I would like to know what the gross domestic product of the narco-bourgeois is in Mexico and around the world, and where, if you don't know, where can I find those statistics?
I have worked on the issue of the narco-bourgeois thing, and the term itself I coined.
So have I.
It's good. We don't have really the statistics that we have. The clearest one is on Colombia. And I mentioned the figure of $47 billion that basically were repatriated. But we do not have a total figure, for instance, how much money they have, the narco-bourgeois in Colombia, for instance, or the narco-bourgeoisie, let alone in the region. But we're talking definitely about if Colombia alone, in the last 10 years or 15 years, they have repatriated $47 billion, you can, Mexico has emerged in the last 5 or 6 years as the leaders in the drug business. So we'll assume that definitely they have amassed double that amount in the last few years, double the amount of the...
Because I have a long time ago seen statistics where they say the percentage of narco money and even total underground black market money within the international banking community. Yeah. I don't remember what those figures are, but it's substantial, something like anywhere from 20 to 10%. And there's all these talks where if you remove that money, it'll be a huge economic blow to the capitalist system. And in a sense, you know, they're playing, on the one hand, they oppress it, and parts of the ruling class are for continuing to oppress the drug trade and all of that. You see this in articles in the Times, in the Wall Street Journal, and other parts are profiteering off it. So there's also factional fighting within the ruling classes on whether to suppress or continue the drug war.
Okay.
One last thing. Look, UNDOC. UNDOC, they have statistics.
UNDOC?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, UNDC. I pronounce it UNDOC. 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 UNDOC, whatever.
Does anyone else have a question? Thank you for your questions.
A lot of what I was hearing described sounds like this hollow frontier of colonization that is known throughout the forested tropics. So a lot of what was described regarding illegal crops. So I'm wondering, what is the evidence and what is the differential between this hollow frontier that you have alluded to in various forms, the one in Honduras or Guatemala or Colombia, and the hollow frontier in Ecuador, and the hollow frontier in Brazil, and the hollow frontier in even Suriname has a hollow frontier now. And so do we actually have an evidence that it's the prohibitionist policy that is conducive to exacerbating or somehow changing, you know, making it more dynamic?
I, for one, will admit my ignorance here and admit to not knowing what the hollow frontier is. Can anyone here, would you like to explain that? Just quickly?
The hollow frontier is described in Ecuador, for example. It's you come in and you clear and you have shifting cultivation, right? And you burn a little bit and then the productivity goes down. And when the productivity goes down, you move on, mm-hmm. right? So, okay. And when you move on, you leave behind a place that's now taken up and it can become properties and you can, you know, you can speculate on it. You can do all kinds of things. And that's responsible, for example, in Brazil, you know, those very high deforestation mm-hmm. rates. They're not because everybody's feeding themselves. They're happening because there's a series of land grabs that are associated with it.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that.
I think that's a great question and really worthy of clarification. So ultimately, the question is, are drugs causing all deforestation? Is the drug trade, is the drug regime responsible? Clearly not. Deforestation happens for a host of reasons. But one of the, I'm working with the team, including a lot of remote sensors and land change scientists, to really pull out the narco signal in land use change in Central America, but the algorithms that are being developed could be applied internationally. And the difference between a group of peasants moving to the forest being displaced from some other area and incrementally moving into the frontier and a narco frontier is that what you get when a drug trafficking node develops, it typically develops in the heart of a remote area that is far from governance and interdiction. And what you'll see is a very different pattern of degradation and deforestation than you would see under the quote-unquote normal development of a frontier. And that is characterized by very rapid transformation of forest to cattle pasture and secondarily plantations. And clearly, I mean, the narco signal that you see from satellites is best described as an extremely highly capitalized, massive transformation, very rapid transformation of land. In the Brazilian Amazon, drug traffickers opened up a 300-hectare area in the space of 3 weeks. That is a very large clearing that appears out of nowhere in the middle of a protected area, in the middle of who has that kind of impunity, capital, and nimbleness to be so destructive. And wherever we have looked at this issue, it is narco-capital that is behind those sorts of activities. Thanks. Does that answer your question? Kind of.
Hi, would you like to come up to the microphone? I think we could probably...
he has an answer too.
But yes.
Of course, yeah. No, I'm not in the business of...
I'm trying to understand that, which is the difference. Because, for example, when we review in satellite and imaginary
from areas colonized with, for example, coca, no cocaine, with coca plant, that make a configuration of pixels that relate the cultivate area and the advance of in new areas and land abandon. And it's a very small areas. It's particularly people clear a piece of forest, almost like escondido.
It's hidden.
Yeah, because it's something illegal. It's people is trying to don't detect them from any mean. But in the case of soybeans or another colonization process, mainly industrial process, or African palm in Colombia, this is another footprint in the landscape. It's another footprint. But this is the remote sensing. This is the eyes of God. You know, you can see from the satellites and that. But what happened in the field with the people behind the process of colonization, there are differences also. There are very differences.
Hi, I'm Julia Willebrand and Green Party of New York. One of the things, thank you very much for all the information you provided. It was very, very interesting and useful to know what it is about the environment that's being damaged through the drug trafficking process. But what I didn't hear, it all sort of, it was passive voice. It happens. You know, I can sit here and as somebody that has run for office and say, I have had as a policy, and I run for a comptroller in New York State, legalizing drugs because of the response, what happens as a result of drugs being illegal in the United States. And I was sitting for the better part of an hour waiting for somebody to mention that elephant in the room before it got mentioned by somebody that came up here to ask a question. And then you still all sort of drew back from saying, who's responsible for the fact that drugs are illegal? Obviously, the United States is a major, major driver of the illegality process, and it doesn't get mentioned. And I was very taken with your discussion of what happens to small farmers when they are forced to go to single export crops. That happens because the IMF drives it, and yet, as interesting as everything you said here, you just left the top out. You know, how does it happen? It happens because at some major level, laws are passed. And I just think it would add to the process if, in fact, you didn't sort of leave it up. It happened. It didn't. It happened. Somebody did it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Does anybody want to react to that? Okay, well, we could take a few questions, and then I think we're nearing the end of the night, but we have time for at least three more questions.
So there are a few models that are represented in capitalism, and I think the reason why capitalism is so enticing or so attractive is because of perfect competition, which is the idea that everybody has, but unfortunately we see that monopolization happens, and that's evident, that usually ends up as the final. So the impact of drug policy on the environment might be a good precursor to the impact of capitalism on the environment, because that's really what it's about. Guillermo was talking about if everyone had a plant in their home, that would be different. We wouldn't have to worry about, you know, so this idea of legalization, I'm not so sure how that all fit into it, but the concept of going back to what you were saying about capitalism, that seems to be the underlying culprit of the whole process in general, is it not?
Thank you.
So how, I mean, that's rhetorical. It seems like everything is rather rhetorical here. So is there, I mean, if the policies,
hey.
I mean, it has to be, right? So if the policies, are failing, maybe we should look at models that can represent a better, perfect marketplace or perfect competition in capitalism. And I realize that we've been trying to do this ever since the the birth of capitalism here in the States, I suppose, but it hasn't worked out so well. So how can we actually gear or create some sort of a policy that can't be failed or fail-proof? How can we do that when we have these sort of issues going on? And I realize this is kind of a funny, maybe immature question, but it seems like capitalism is the largest impact. It seems to have the most impact on the environment, and that all goes back to the conversation.
Okay, thank you. Well, we're taking a couple at a time here.
Hi. Well, first I'd like to thank you all for a really interesting discussion. I've got a couple of questions, perhaps. First, I was working early this year at UNEP, incidentally, where a lot of our work focused on transnational organized crime and trying to control wildlife trafficking, natural resource trafficking, and all the financial flows that arise from that, which is a huge problem for forests, as you mentioned, and all kinds of natural resources, including minerals and even endangered species. So one of the issues that I was looking at is how non-state actors in conflicted regions kind of get into that trade and are able to exploit natural resources that are in other parts of the world are legal resources, legal commodities, and traffic them out. They then launder them into you know, through secondary markets into like legal economies. So I'm just wondering how legalizing or somehow normalizing drugs and coca plantations, how will that really help, you know, to minimize the sort of pernicious aspects of the drug trade, seeing as so many non-state actors are already involved around the world in drugs, and we can even talk about ISIS in Syria, who are actually profiting off of marijuana and other, you know, narco trafficants in Latin America. I don't know, is that clear? Mm-hmm. Secondly, I traveled also in South America and I met people who had formerly been child slaves or child laborers on, I guess that's slavery, on coca plantations. And it seemed to me that, you know, we talk about indigenous land rights and securing land tenure for indigenous people, but a lot of the plantations in Colombia, at least, are not necessarily like owned by indigenous people. They're not run by indigenous people, or at least controlled by them. So how will like normalizing the drug agricultural industry help in securing indigenous land tenure and prevent it from becoming like a large, just another kind of capitalist sector of the economy controlled by corporations or large owners of capital? Thanks.
We'll do one more, and then we will do our best to work our way through all of these. I mean, these are good questions. Thank you.
Yeah. I'd like to thank you for this very educational panel. And just that fact that this is an education for all of us. And can we pull together a curriculum for our schools? Because if we do not have users, we don't have buyers, and then we don't have a market. In the U.S., we did have a Say No to Drugs program. I'm not sure how effective that was.
Okay. Thank you. You know, I just wanted to start just briefly, a brief statement as kind of the moderator of this and as somebody who does programming like this for a living in my own organization. You know, we've touched on some broad issues tonight. We've touched on drug legalization. We've touched on capitalism during the initial presentation that that Nazir made. At some point, you know, a decision is made to bring a narrow or a somewhat narrow focus to these discussions. I mean, we have here tonight, we have a director of forest campaigns, we have a professor of geography, we have a researcher and team leader at comparative social studies group, and we have an associate professor and director of Latin American studies. Each of these people is very esteemed in their field, but I think the purpose tonight was to produce and present some very specific findings that were made in this report and to debate the points around it. And certainly, you know, you could argue that capitalism, for example, is at the root of these things, but that was just not, that was not originally the mission tonight. So on that note, I'd like to invite our panelists to answer the questions as they see fit.
Well, thanks, and I don't want to take too long. I mean, clearly the conversation is just beginning. One of the reasons for writing this report was to provoke discussion on the links between drug policy and the environment, and I think that's exactly what we're doing. In answer to your questions, we're talking about the 1961 UN Convention on Narcotic Drugs, and that must be reformed. And that is exactly what will be debated in April at UNGAS. And let's keep a close eye on that process and push for transparency around the discussion and hope that these issues get debated. Two, yes, I mean, it's capitalism, but we're not going to see huge changes in capitalism anytime soon. What we can see are changes in the way, in the particular form that capitalism takes. And right now we're living under a regime of neoliberal globalization, which favors financial deregulation, opening up of markets, and a host of other things that absolutely benefits illicit actors, very well-connected elite actors at the top, and creates great disparities in between the winners and the losers. And right now, what we're seeing is the winners in the drug war are the banks and the many well-positioned top elite actors across the spectrum, and the losers are not just the people dying in the streets every day and across the world in drug-fueled conflicts, but the global environment. Therefore, we are all losers when it comes to issues like climate change, because this is not an insignificant driver of climate change. Third, I think the issue, why does securing indigenous land rights help, how is that related to what we're talking about? Well, the indigenous people I work with in eastern Honduras and the Mosquito Coast have very few tools at their disposal with which to protect themselves when drug traffickers move into their lands, and one of the few things they could mobilize would be land title. When they don't have it, they're really left just petitioning the government for help, and of course the government has looked away. They filed something like 300 reports of land invasion to absolutely no effect. So they need something, they need tools to work with and push back, and land tenure is one way to start that. About educating, forgot where that person is. The head of the Scottish Botanical Garden told me that they have run an extremely successful program. Apparently, Scotland has the highest per capita cocaine use in the world, and by running a program that educated cocaine users in Scotland about the cost of their habit, they were able to really change the discussion around the just say no to drugs discussion. So I thought that was inventive, and it came out of the botanical garden, and it gets back to the linking the two ends of the commodity chain. And it's not the peasants growing the crops who are doing well off of this trade, and it's not the users who are doing well. It's all the middlemen, and they are mostly men, who are making a killing and doing a lot of damage in the process. Thank you.
Well, maybe overarching conclusions would be, for a great number of years, UNODC, right? UNODC had depended on a policy that is based on the issue of policing, making too costly for the peasants to continue the production of coca, and therefore emphasizing the deterrent aspect of the drug production process. I think this has to be reversed. We need to create incentives to the peasants to produce other crops, and this cannot be done without a sustainable development strategies for most of the nations involved in the coca production, i.e. Colombia, Peru, Bolivia. So in a way, if I want to recommend just succinctly, is to develop a sustainable development strategy that relies on the subsistence peasant economy and revitalize this economy and support that economy. All agencies of the United Nations, all groups, NGOs must be in the task of supporting the peasant economy in the region. The reason why this is the peasant economy, the subsistence peasant economy in Latin America and also in Africa, is the basic provider of food. 60% of most of the food products in Latin America, in spite of all new liberalization and all the economic policies and all the problems that had affected the rural economy, still this is the most resilient one. The lesson drawn is peasantry had depended on coca to subsidize its food production, to subsidize it, not to substitute it totally. So consequently, therefore, develop a strategy, international strategy, so to support that subsistence peasant economy, specifically in the coca-producing nations, could be another mean of fighting or containing the drug epidemic. So therefore, again, this is thinking outside the box again, and therefore it's not thinking in one unilinear or one dimension or one component of fighting this war and maybe bringing it to a more suitable conclusion. And that's it. I will stop here.
Just to the question from the woman from or previously at UNEP about illegal logging. One unique feature of the rosewood trade is that it's primarily destined for Chinese markets. Unlike the U.S., Europe, and Australia, China does not have currently in place a prohibition on illegally sourced wood products. So the Chinese market is fundamentally a no-questions-asked market, and those responsible for importing are not asked to understand their supply chain at all. They bear no responsibility for where they're sourcing from and what the impacts of their sourcing policies are. And it follows from efforts to protect species in Southeast Asia and Madagascar that you're seeing this shifting marketplace. I guess I say that as a distinction because in this context where you have essentially capital accumulation in the major consuming countries of the world, they should bear some responsibility for their sourcing practices, right? And I think that is... not entirely at odds with some of the ideas that have been put together here about potential reforms in the drug policy. And I think that it goes to the point of empowering and lifting up local governance and not either impacting it with transnational organized crime or imposing an outside agenda on it.
Okay, well... thanks, everybody. Thank you to the Open Societies Foundation. Thank you to all of our panelists. Great discussion. We touched on a lot. Thanks to all of you for being here. And, you know, I think some of us are going to stick around after the discussion's over. So thank you and good night.